Good morning, everybody. Welcome. We're delighted to have you here. My name is John Hamry. I'm the president at CSIS, and I'm delighted that all of you could join us. This is going to be an interesting conversation, and we're pleased to have this opportunity. My role here is entirely ornamental, don't please. It was really to introduce and to say thank you to a very, very good friend, Mike Hayden. General Hayden, I've had the privilege of working with him for many years, back when he was in the Air Force, and of course went up to NSA and then went to the CIA. Doing a spectacular job. Oh, he had a tour in DNI, as I recall, as well. So this is a man who's been at the very stratosphere of American intelligence circles, and of course, a backdrop during those years when he was at the very top, he was dealing with issues of global terrorism, and retains this commitment to bring a focus, a policy focus in this area for all of us. And we're grateful for that. And we're fortunate to have him with his commitment and energy doing it. He was approached, I'm not exactly sure how he was approached, to become a contributor to the foreword in this volume. And this is quite a volume. And again, it reflects General Hayden's personal commitment. This is a mission that is not over, and it's a mission he still embraces. And we're very fortunate that someone of his talent and character is willing to open up this session today. So would you please, with your applause, welcome General Mike Hayden.
Thank you very much for the kind introduction. I feel as if I can't go on without mentioning Dr. Hamry's seminal. No, there? Okay. How we doing? Better? All right. Thanks. Well, I wanted to mention that I can't go on the formal part of the program without mentioning Dr. Hamry's seminal op-ed last week on the American clearance process, which I think has had more impact than any other op-ed in the security sphere since George Kennan's X article 65 years ago. And if you haven't seen it, you must. I'm honored to be part of the program here today. I was not dragooned into this effort. When I became aware of what the Henry Jackson Society wanted to do in the United States, mirroring what they'd already done in the United Kingdom, I was enthusiastic about it. If you look at the foreword, I mention a session that I had in front of one of our oversight committees. I was working with Charlie Allen. We were the two folks who were testifying. Charlie is an iconic CIA figure, 50 years at the agency, but at the time he was the chief of intelligence for the Department of Homeland Security. And we were asked about the homegrown threat. And frankly, we weren't all that prepared for it. It wasn't something that was in our three-ring binders preparing for the testimony. But we both answered. We both answered independently. And we both pretty much said the same thing. And what we said, without any pre-coordination, was that we in the United States are a bit blessed by our history, a bit blessed by our status as an immigrant nation. That we would expect this might be less of a problem for us than perhaps some of our European allies, but that it would become a problem for us, that this issue we could see on the horizon. And sadly, as I think I mentioned in the foreword, since that testimony, we've had Najib al-Azazi going to New York to attack the subway system, Fazel Shahzad in Times Square, a drive-by shooting in Little Rock, Arkansas, and then Major Nidal Hassan at Fort Hood. I've taken to describing the threat. I put my arm out and I relate a bunch of things that have happened, all big deals. 9/11, World Trade Center 1, which was 20 years ago today. The airliner plot over the Pacific, Bojinka. The airliner plot over the Atlantic, 2006. And frankly, I point out that although an intelligence officer almost never says never, the ability of Al-Qaeda to do that kind of plot is very, very much reduced. And so what do we see? And then I relate the attacks I just described for you. And then I kind of paraphrase Secretary Napolitano and say, the Secretary never quite said it this way, but I think it's a fair summation of her view of the current threat. Future attacks against the American homeland will be less well organized, less complex, less likely to succeed, less lethal even if they do succeed. They're just going to be more numerous. And I think I would add, and more likely to be conducted by citizens or long-term residents of the United States. And that's why I think this volume has great value, because this is a tough issue for us. I mean, look at our own debates over the renewal of the Patriot Act, or our own debates about what Ray Kelly and the New York Police Department are doing. I mean, those are kind of flashpoints in the national debate. I'm personally quite comfortable with both Patriot Act and NYPD, but I also recognize that what it is the act says, what it is NYPD does, are legitimate issues for a democracy like our own. Now, I'm going to relate an incident that took place, I'm almost certain, in midsummer 2002. I don't think it was 03, I think it was 2002. And I, trust me, I'm being a bit cartoonish here, all right? The colors are too bold, the brush is too wide, you know, the tablet too plain. But we were in the Oval talking with President Bush with an incredible volume of ambient background noise of potential attacks against our Independence Day celebrations, particularly on the Mall, where, what, 2.5 million of our countrymen would be cheek by jowl for most of the day. And because we only had the ambient background noise and no further precision, and again, I'm being cartoonish here, all right? But it seemed to me, and no one said these words, but it seemed to me that the only options we actually had out there for the president was cancel the 4th of July, or put every American with a hyphen in their last name in some sort of preventive detention. I mean, none of those are realistic proposals, but you get the point. We had nothing more precise in which we could offer the president to deal with what we are perceiving to be an increased threat. This document is fact-based, and it does that. And I need to point out, I hope no one reads this document as targeting any Americans or any subgroups in America. This is not sweeping through Minneapolis, St. Paul, or Dearborn, or Fremont, California in any way. This is not about targeting Americans or American groups. This is about being aware of what Americans are targeted by Al-Qaeda for recruitment, so that we can help these targeted groups by them withstand these kinds of effort. We need to do this with a very clear mind. We need to do this unburdened by prejudice or by political correctness. We are a free people. Even though we see increased dangers, we should not allow those dangers to change our DNA. And by being able to be so precise, so accurate as to whence the threat might come, we will be able to preserve our identity as a free and welcoming society. And that's why I was enthusiastic when I saw what this work would contain. And with that, let me stop. The folks who really know the data here is Robin, who put this together, and I believe he's got some details that he would like to share with you, and then I believe we have a conversation after that.
I believe we do. Robin?
Sure, thank you. Thank you all for coming today to listen to the result of what was a close to an 18-month project looking at terrorism trends within the United States. The report itself looks at 171 individuals. 171 individuals, and there are many, many different figures floating around as to the exact total. Myself and Emily Dyer, my co-author, were extremely, extremely precise in analyzing what constituted an Al-Qaeda-related offense. And we came up with a figure of 171 from 1997 to 2011. So after we'd got to that figure, the plan was to analyze trends within this movement looking at very, very specific categories. So we looked at age, gender, nationality, ancestry, place of residence, education levels, occupation, whether they were religious converts or not, the type of offense committed, whether they pleaded guilty, the sentence they received, whether they were subject to an undercover investigation, whether they'd received terrorist training, whether they had combat experience, and whether they were linked to designated terrorist organizations. To give you a brief bit of context as to how I came to this work, in the UK, I mean, this report essentially has its roots in the UK's failures in counterterrorism strategy. After the July 2005 bombings in London that killed 52, the government, official government review into those events said that they didn't even have a list at that stage of individuals who'd been convicted of terrorism offences in the UK. I thought that was such a shaming revelation to my mind as to our failures in the UK that I began to put together the list for them, essentially, and after we had the list, the next logical step was to find out not just a list of names, but who were these people? Where did they live in England? Where did they go to school? What kind of job did they have? So we published a document in 2010 outlining some of this with an update in 2011 that became subsequently an important part of the British government's review into radicalization and its review into counterterrorism. And that's why, as I see the American attempts to combat this problem, I thought it would be something worthwhile introducing to the US as well. So the idea was to make this as comprehensive as possible, but what you can't do is project a linear line as to the threats either increasing or decreasing, because there are significant spikes, it changes year in, year out, and it's extremely unpredictable. So there was a significant increase in individuals charged and subsequently convicted after 9/11, but then a big reduction by 2008, which preceded then a huge increase in 2009. Now I'm yet to see really. There's many things you could speculate as to why those could be, but what we saw tracking the year-on-year threat was that there were huge spikes. It wasn't predictable. So if we go to the first thing to look at is the age range of some of these individuals. This is about, I would say, as unsurprising as you're going to get in terms of the statistics. It's no great secret that younger men, and it was the vast majority men, are those most likely to be drawn to this. You see a third were between 20 and 24. There was, though, some surprising, strange caveats to this as we did the research. So, I mean, you see the 50-plus category. The oldest individual we had was a 63-year-old at time of charge called Hawo Hassan, who was conspiring to provide material support for al-Shabaab. And so there was while the age range was to an extent predictable and that you knew it was essentially going to be between 20 and 34, there were all sorts of strange caveats that came up during the work. So while we may not be surprised as to that it's young men, it is surprising as to, I think, who these men were. You see the majority, 54%, were US citizens. To my mind, that suggests a change in perception of the way we need to think about the threat in the US. I think of it in this way, in that the formative experience this country had with this kind of terrorism was 9/11. It was planned by a Saudi based in Afghanistan using various operatives from around the Middle East and North Africa. Now, 54% of the overall level were US citizens, far and away above any nationality remotely nearby. You see Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, Sudan. But the majority of the threat was from the US. Of those U.S. citizens, by the way, for 54%, but 36% were U.S. born. So these aren't just all individuals, citizens who've come from other countries and gained citizenship. Many of these are born in the U.S. and with all the opportunities that provides. Next, we looked at employment and education levels. The perception, I think, certainly in the U.K., although I believe it's still to an extent in the U.S., is that perhaps some of these individuals have lack economic opportunities, they've fallen on hard times, the socioeconomic aspect to this, and I'm not discounting that at all because I think it remains relevant. But it's not always the case, and I would say it's not even the case in the majority of the time. So this stat about 57% of individuals being in employment or education, I think is significant. We broke it down further, and it showed there was 44% that were in employment, 13% were students. And of the total overall, 20% of individuals were skilled employment. So we had computer programmers, software engineers, pharmacists, financial analysts. It was a broad range of individuals in skilled employment. So the perception that 9/11 brought about the way maybe the individuals to look for, the type of terrorists from far-flung tribal towns in Saudi Arabia, I think it has to begin to change because it's U.S. citizens who are mostly well-educated, most employed. They've not been marginalized by the system. They've passed through it as much as anything. So we then looked at where these individuals lived. This is where I do my weatherman impression, I guess, but... you can see dotted around California, a significant amount, Texas in the south, Florida, Illinois going a little more to the Midwest, and then the Virginia and North Carolina. The most amount of individuals were in New York as their last place of residence prior to charge. And I think almost the New York figure, it even somewhat underplays it because a lot of New York was not only the place of residence for a lot of people, it was a real hub of movement, even dating back to the early 1990s and some of the activities there. So the three most popular states were New York, Florida, and New Jersey, but I think special focus on New York. Just as a comparison, by the way, because it is interesting sometimes to... When I've been going through this data and looking at the London equivalent, in the UK, London individuals residing there are responsible for almost half of the overall offences. So in many ways in the UK, it's a lot easier to know where the threat may emanate from, whereas obviously in the US, what you see here, I think, is a great, great level of diversity. We then moved on to religious converts. So converts are now responsible. 23% of individuals who committed al-Qaeda-related offences were converts. I was extremely... I mean, this is much higher. The UK is around 15, 16%. This was a much, much higher figure. So the idea that all these individuals, say, are born into... born into perhaps extremely strict religion is not something that is borne out by the stats. We did a comparison year by year breakdown of the proportion of offences committed by converts, and as a proportion, in 8 of the 15 years, religious converts actually committed more offences than non-converts. This is also extremely relevant to the U.S. situation. 54% of U.S.-born individuals who committed these offences were converts. 95% of the total of converts were U.S. citizens. So this is something I think it is one of the most significant findings of the report. That's the... just to clarify, 54% on the left, US born. So we then tried to, in an attempt to just add another level of sophistication to the analysis, break down each individual's role in their in their terrorism offence. So we broke this down into five categories of active participants. So they were either fully pledged members of Al-Qaeda who'd sworn loyalty to bin Laden, or those who were at the very, very sharpest end of actively plotting operationally an attack against the US. And that made up the biggest number. That was 37%. A quarter were aspirants, so they were individuals who'd shown an interest in terrorism, but whose plans weren't in any way fully developed. Then we had facilitators, who made up over a fifth. They were people who were transferring money, documentation, all the almost the administrative work that needs to take place for terrorism to be a threat. And then we had trained aspirants, so they were individuals who'd also expressed an interest and in committing a terrorist act, but had actually gone that stage of receiving training in training camps abroad. And the lowest number were ideologues on 2%. Now, the ideologues are a low number, but I think that's partly to do with the way the US legislation is framed. So the incitement crimes, which is a reasonably common actually in the UK, the rhetorical crimes weren't as common in the US, and different parts of legislation were used to convict people for those sorts of crimes. So when we then decided how could we assess further who were the most serious people in this, and we thought it'd be worth finding out who had actually gone that step, not just talking about terrorism, not just based in the US and sounding off about it, but who had actually taken that step to go to foreign training camps, receive training. Almost half of individuals had, 47%. Again, higher than the UK equivalent. And where they received training, you can see Afghanistan, Pakistan, the most common. Some of the other states, like Somalia and Yemen, are much smaller numbers. I still think that trend of individuals going to those locations is yet to play itself out fully. I think if we were to do a study in another 15 years, you'd see a much higher number from those countries. And of US citizens, a third had also received training. But what you don't see is a linear progression from those who receive training to then going on to get combat experience. So it's a much lower figure of individuals who... So we had a lot of individuals. I'll give you an example of, say, the Lackawanna Six, who received training in Al-Farouk in the summer of 2001, but didn't go on to then to fight in a foreign war zone. So Afghanistan was the most popular of those that did, with Bosnia and Somalia coming in behind, but essentially it was the amount with combat experience was at significantly lower than we may expect, considering the amount that had actually trained. We then looked at how many individuals were linked to designated terrorist organizations, and you can see from the key there some of those groups that we assessed as Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda inspired. So 57% of individuals were linked to designated terrorist organizations, of which, perhaps unsurprisingly, in a study about Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda was by far the most. So finally, we went to the mass casualty operatives. Again, this was an attempt all the time to make sure who were the most serious individuals. And over a fifth, 21%, were mass casualty operatives of individuals that are actively planning terrorist attacks that would lead to multiple deaths, huge-scale loss of life in the US. Now, you see the significance of... I mean, Afghanistan is obviously a very popular location for this, but I think the one to really look out for, and again, one to look out for in the future, is the no training, which is only 11% at the moment, but I think is quite significant, because this shows that there are individuals out there who didn't feel the need to receive training in a Pakistan, a Somalia, or a Yemen. They were people who were inspired by the ideology and genuinely thought this is something that we can, this is something that can be achieved without, in the non-traditional way that Al-Qaeda groups have operated. So the example of this, and the general referred to this individual earlier, but the drive-by shootings in Little Rock, Arkansas, the individual went to Yemen, didn't manage to receive training, was unsuccessful, but decided that he could go back to the US and do something anyway. He was inspired by not only the ideology, but his time in foreign countries to then try and attack the US homeland. So I'm gonna leave it there for now. There's lots of information in there. This is, I think, top line selection of some of the findings. There isn't an exact science to this stuff. That's obvious. There's no real way to track radicalization perfectly, knowing where these guys come from and what it may be that will make people pursue terrorist cause and terrorist causes more generally. But I hope these statistics go some way to gaining somewhat of a better understanding, or at least to begin the conversation. Thank you.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Robin. By way of introduction, my name is Stephanie Sanek. I'm the acting director of the Homeland Security and Counterterrorism Program here at CSIS. As the moderator, I have two hopefully short questions for our guests today, and then I will open it up to questions from the audience. My first question is for you, Robin. The initial volume that you put together was about, for lack of a better phrase, homegrown terrorists or Islamic terrorism in the UK. And then you proceeded on to this US volume. Can you talk a little bit about things that might have surprised you entering this study of Al-Qaeda in the United States and things that came out from the analysis differently than you expected?
Yeah, well, there were many surprising things. Actually, the first one that I've got to tell you, and you may be surprised at, is just how much easier it is to do in the US. In the UK, I can't tell you the problem we had trying to get official court documentation, trying to get official charges from the British court system. It was extremely, extremely opaque. So the American system was much more transparent. So that was helpful on that regard. In terms of the ins and outs of the data, I was surprised by the high level of converts in the US, which is higher than the UK. The individuals in the US generally are better trained, better educated, and to my mind, as deeply serious as some of the individuals in the UK were, I think the US is ramped up another notch in terms of the individuals we've seen profiled in this report. There are a lot of the threat in the US is just so much more diverse as well. I think that the fact that in England, in the UK, London and Birmingham, which is the second major city, was responsible for so much of the overall threat. In the US, I wasn't expecting when I started doing this research to find many individuals in Texas, in Oregon. It wasn't something I expected to see a lot of, but there was such a diverse amount of people spread all over the country. I mean, that's one of the things that really stuck with me, I think, during the research.
And did you see any connections among the individuals you researched, the 171 cases?
There were definitely connections between some, sure, and there was also connections between people in the US going back to people in the UK and in Europe generally. But, and this is something which perhaps we can speak more about, my sense is that probably that the amount of people who don't have those connections may increase, because all the work that the US has done and its allies in trying to disrupt these kind of networks suggests to me it will be harder to maintain that kind of large cell structure that we saw, especially in the immediate post 9/11 world. So that's kind of how I see the trends.
That leads very well into my next question, which is for you, General Hayden. When people in the United States think about counterterrorism operations or efforts, they think about what we are doing overseas, and there's a lot that the U.S. government, with allies and partners, what we've done to tamp down on folks coming into the United States with intention to conduct either a mass casualty operation or other. Can you talk a little bit about why we're seeing more homegrown terrorism as reflected in Robin's data?
Yes and no, in terms of why. I think one reason is it's more visible for us because the, for want of a better metaphor, the water level in the terrorist lake has gone down. In other words, those things we used to fear most, that slow-moving, well-organized, complex plot against an iconic target designed to create mass casualties is frankly less threatening to us today than it was 10 or 11 years ago. And now, perhaps as a result of that dynamic, but also a result of a dynamic that Al-Qaeda has to give up its kind of doctrinal preference for that kind of an attack and then rely on these more low-level kinds of assaults, brings this more to the fore. That really becomes important for someone like me, and again, back to why I appreciated the study. This isn't in my wheelhouse, despite or maybe even because of my background. I mean, I headed two large foreign intelligence organizations, and so many of the folks that Robin suggests to you don't come into our field of view until they do show up in Afghanistan or they do show up in Pakistan. But I participated in the dialogue, and what this report underscores is a reality I think we all recognized about midday on September 11, 2001, that our old distinctions between foreign and domestic, between law enforcement and intelligence, were pretty ill-suited. Remember, I think ill-suited generally for a globalized world, but particularly ill-suited for this kind of problem. And so, again, I think the data here allows us to approach it in a rational way, not driven by our fears, but driven by true information. What I would really like to see is a dialogue about this information with America's heritage communities, those folks I mentioned before in Minneapolis and Dearborn and Fremont, and to gain their insight to what this data suggests to them.
Well, thank you for that. I would like to open it up to questions from the audience. We have a couple of ground rules here. Given the sensitivity of mics, if people could turn their smartphones and whatnot to either silent or stun, we'd appreciate it. And if you jump up, I'll assume you have a question, not that you've been stunned. And a couple of things. When the microphone comes to you, if you wouldn't mind stating your name and your affiliation and ask a question, we'd really appreciate it. So questions. That man right in the back first.
John Kunstadter, Red Zima Photo. General, in the spirit of your comment about retaining our DNA and our liberty and not falling into political correctness, may I ask what religion these people converted to? And also, is the open terrorist threat any greater than the threat of what Andrew McCarthy and others have called the Grand Jihad? Thank you.
Okay. Well, let me defer to Robin on the conversion aspect.
Well, I mean, they're all converts to Islam, and from mainly from Christianity of the converts.
And with regard to, you know, is this a narrow problem or a big problem? My instincts are that we can mishandle the narrow problem badly enough to turn it into the larger problem. And that's why I welcome the information, so that, you know, this isn't about communities. It's not about large monotheistic religious groups. It's about individuals who, for one reason or another, in a small group, are attracted to the symbol of 9/11 rather than repelled by the symbolism 9/11. I just want to understand that better. And look, I'm willing to accept the possibility that this has a lot more to do with the Crips and the Bloods than it does with the Quran or the Hadith. That maybe this is just one expression in a post-industrial society of how young people who are rootless deal with alienation. Right? Now, that doesn't dismiss it. It doesn't make it unimportant. In fact, it's a particular form of embrace that makes the alienated even more dangerous, but because it kind of rides a global wave of some sort of legitimacy. But I'd focus on the particulars here now and not quite go as far as Andrew does, and I read a lot of his stuff, in drawing it to a grand design yet.
Okay. That gentleman way in the back, please.
J.G. Green, WTOP Radio. General and Robin, there was a trial in Birmingham not too long ago where three men, I think, were found guilty of terrorism charges. And in that process, it seemed as though they were revealing a new strategy for attacking the West. And it seemed to be teach others how to do it. Is that what you got out of that? And is that indeed what the U.S. needs to look at and worry about at this point?
I think I'm extremely glad that's been brought up, actually. I mean, this has just wrapped up in the UK last week, a conviction of a large cell who were planning to detonate rucksacks, bombs in rucksacks in the UK. And this idea that, I mean, Al-Qaeda were very keen, I think this is right, to say to them, teach others how to do this, because they're obviously having problems getting the information out. The other thing that I thought was really significant about that case was that from the taps and the information and the transcripts of what some of the bombers were saying, is that Al-Qaeda were actually almost not encouraging people to go out to Pakistan because it was getting so dangerous for operatives there to be based. So they were keener on them taking this approach of do it yourself in your homeland. Don't come. Don't bring the heat that going to Pakistan entails. So I think that case in the UK is extremely significant of where we could be seeing wider terrorism trends going.
Great. We have a gentleman all the way up front. I'm making Grace run around. Sorry about that, Grace. It's okay. Thank you
very much. Hi, Ron Marks. Actually doing some work here at the Institute of the Transnational Threats Initiative with RNode. Question for you guys. This is an interesting report, but let me go to one step beyond. Mike knows we have limited resources at this point, whether law enforcement or intelligence. If someone looks at you right now, Robin, and says, who's the guy? Where's the tipping point here? Who's the person that's going to go from being angry to actually taking action? What would you say? You've called it. I mean, this is your report, kiddo.
Right.
So you laid all this out. So the question I have as an intelligence officer of 30 years is, who am I focusing on now? If this is the case, who am I focusing on?
I mean, I said in the remarks that radicalization, I mean, obviously isn't an exact science. All you can do really is I think, go and look at the trends and say, well, who's the majority, I mean, of each? So we can tell where the most amount live, you can see what their age is, you can say what kind of educational background they can have, you can see what kind of, whether they'll be employed or not, you can track, if you've got this information, whether they've been trained or not. Now that doesn't give you the answer, I know, but what the report does tell you, as much as anything, the likelihood of each of these characteristics we've looked at as to who it will be. Now I would bring it back to, there's numerous cases that have just shot, I think, all analysts since 2001 of things they didn't see coming. There was a case in the UK, an individual called Nicky Riley, who had learning difficulties, who tried to set a bomb off in a restaurant in southern England, was on the absolute dregs periphery of what the security services at that time, the people they were monitoring, and he very nearly killed people in large amounts. Now, he was somebody... He was a white convert, but it's hard to say just how much of a surprise that came to individuals in the UK. So unfortunately, as you know, there will never be a great perfect answer, but what I hope the data does do is provide enough of a background about who these individuals are that you could then begin to make more informed decisions.
Thanks. There's this man right up front, please. And then we'll get to that side of the room, I promise.
Hi there. Dan Prieto, IBM, and an adjunct here at CSIS. If you could go a level deeper on the analysis and just tell us if you looked at some of the things that analysts here have talked about as being trends. Are there more lone wolves versus cells? You know, what percentage are foreign-inspired but with no foreign operating and financial links? What percentage are web-recruited and self-radicalized? an attack type? Is it still transit number one, national monuments number two? And is there a trend? Is there really a trend toward self-radicalization and lone wolf, as people have predicted?
The lone wolves we looked at, the statistic, I believe the overall statistic of individuals was 4%. The lone wolves, I'm not entirely comfortable with this lone wolves classification, because there were some people in the report that genuinely had little interaction with other individuals, be it under a cover of informants or actual terrorist facilitators, who inspired themselves to do something. But the number was so small, and you didn't really see a huge increase year on year. So I'm a little skeptical still about the lone wolf trend, because I think there is, in a lot of the cases people regard as lone wolves, there are still people on the edges of those plots. And the second one was
targets.
And the cells, of course. Yeah. I think cells still. Cells are a lot harder, obviously. The likes of the huge, for example, the transatlantic liquid cell, the huge amounts of individuals that are involved in that UK plot. I think it's just so much harder for Al Qaeda to pull that off now than it was before. So they may prefer to use the individual actors. In terms of where it's been targeted, I still think that they're going to use transport as a way to attack. I mean, we all know about the attacks use of aviation, but an example of one of the individuals in there, an individual called Taher Yazar, who was very clearly taken by this ideology, idolized Mohammed Atta, aspired to go to Iraq and Afghanistan beforehand, and his way this manifests itself in him taking a car and trying to run over students in North Carolina. Now, there were no fatalities, people were wounded, but I mean, on a much, much lower scale, it's the same principle, right? It's using transport to kill on a large scale. So I don't see any real reason to know why that's changed yet, but I mean, if there's one thing that's been consistent over the period of this study, is just how often we've been surprised on how Al-Qaeda's are changed.
The woman in purple?
Hi, Christine Vargas, recent graduate, Johns Hopkins SAIS. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being here. I spent some time working in the Afghan immigrant community in Queens back in 2009, and with a women's rights group got sent to their Kabul office in 2011. So I have my own personal observations on why some of the young men in these communities radicalize, but I'd love to hear both of you elaborate on a couple of key grievances and whether or not they can be addressed through American political means. And from a tactical standpoint, having had a couple of chats with JTTF in New York, how is this new research, this wonderful new metrics you've got up here, being utilized by JTTF nationwide? Thanks so much.
Let me just suggest one thought that I've had that I want to explore the data to see if it presents itself to answer the question or leads to more questions that lead to answers. You mentioned, why are we seeing more of this now? And I suggested, well, maybe it's not so new, it's just new to us because it's no more visible. But I have to open myself to the possibility that it is new. And it might be tied to the reality, or more importantly, the perception of what it is our government has done over the course of 10 or 11 years. And again, my own personal credentials, fairly aggressive response to the threat. But I also understand how we deal with the near-term threat. The jihadist who's already convinced that he wants to do us harm and is kind of figuratively coming in over the wire, that how we choose to deal with that actually does affect, for want of a better term, the production rate of those who might want to do that to us in 1, 3, 5, or 7 years. And so I would, as I suggested, a dialogue with our heritage communities as to what they think contributes to this motivation. If there is a proximate cause to the uptick, and if part of that proximate cause is the perception of U.S. government actions. Now, we may decide, well, that's the cost of doing business, and what we're doing is quite legitimate, and therefore we may want to continue it, or it opens up our political process for other alternatives as well. But I do think it's a legitimate question that needs to be answered.
The only thing I would add on that is Because this isn't just a data set. In the report, there's an in-depth profile of every case. And of course, in a lot of them, you see foreign grievances being brought up. The flashpoints we're aware of, be it from Iraq to Kashmir to Chechnya. And so I can't say that I'm just dismissing all those, because of course these are obviously things that that people in this profile felt, at least some have felt, very viscerally. I guess the only thing I would say is, though, from the US's point of view, I think there's only so much really you can do about that. I think you have to decide what your best and soundest policy is to tackle that and pursue that, and it may cause some levels of radicalization, but then is your policy based on what makes the most amount of people happy, or is it based on what's best for the nation? So I think it's a very tricky one to balance. And the JTTF, we'll see. I hope they like it.
Grace, this guy all the way down in front in the middle.
Thanks.
Thank you. Stefan Gruber, Euronews, European Television. General Hayden, we've heard a lot about cyber attacks and cyber terrorism recently. Is Al-Qaeda capable of committing cyber terrorist acts? What's your take on this? Thank you.
Yeah, my sense is they are indeed capable, because it's so easy to do. If the frustrated 16-year-old in his mom's basement can do harm, I'm sure an organization as sophisticated as this one can. I've been very impressed with Al-Qaeda's use of the web. Recruit, train, gain finances, organize, proselytize, and so on. I personally have been a little surprised that they've not chosen to use the web as a venue of conflict, to use the web as actual attack. I can't explain it, and that's all so I won't attempt. But it certainly is a potential, since they have shown great mastery of the World Wide Web for other purposes. They just haven't used it as an attack weapon.
Thanks. Grace, this man in the green sweater behind. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Andrew Volpe from AEI. I'm actually curious to know, with having a neuroscience background, I'm really always trying to get to the core reason for people's kind of actions. And so I'm curious to know, this is for Robin, actually. In your analysis, were you able to obtain any kind of information that would lead you to believe there's any commonalities between people in their psychological states or their personal kind of childhoods, or kind of fleshing out all the information maybe you got from police reports or any kind of information like that that would really give you a sense of what kind of background these people might have in terms of maybe they had grievances in the past against the United States, or even just they have mommy issues, you know what I mean? Just, are there any kind of thing, I know I'm kind of making fun of that, but in reality, you know, humans, generally, there's something behind it. And certainly when you get to the point where you go from, I'm really angry at the United States, to now I'm gonna carry out an attack, there's some sort of extremism that might be explained by some sort of psychological issue in the past. So do you think that would be a possible thing? And did you consider doing it? If so, thank you.
Well, I don't have the numbers and stats on it, but I do know from the reports where you're going, and I think it's important and relevant. The one, so for example, the convert specifically, I think is interesting, because there was a lot of, especially around the kind of the atmosphere that originally led to the conversion taking place, there was social dislocation in those individuals. There was often a troubled background. Now, it wasn't always meaning that people were in and out of jail, but you often had people skirmishes with the law. I see this a lot in the UK cases as well. A lot of the UK individuals that went to Guantanamo Bay were based in Afghanistan and since got sent to Guantanamo Bay. There was a lot of personal individual issues that even led to traveling to Afghanistan in the first place. Now, I'm not saying that all the terrorists have, as you put it memorably, as mommy issues, but there is no way that these are all entirely well-balanced, happy individuals. I mean, there's definitely some social issues. I mean, the general talked about the gang issue as well. I think that's a really under-researched piece of the picture on the radicalization front. People like Jose Padilla, very strong and significant and lengthy gang background. So there are a lot of things that go into the mix here, and I think they're all worth looking at more.
Thanks. We have time for one more question. Guy on the fringe there, please.
Is it on? Yeah. John Cole Closure. I teach over at Command and General Staff School. We've been hitting around it, but I'm very interested in the dynamic of the conversion, the religious conversion. Do we know somebody who's out there, Christian, maybe happy, suddenly, what is it that switches them to Islam and then puts them on this path? What was it that attracted them? The dynamics? Was it the web? They just didn't wander into a mosque, I'm assuming.
No, I think that there was a range of combinations going in. But like, let's say somebody like John Walker Lind, who ended up fighting with the Taliban. He had a fantastic, affluent background, but felt very, very out of place in his social settings. He was sent to a school where you could dictate your own hours, and so there was the impression that he didn't really have much structure to his life. He then got involved looking at a lot of chat forums and the internet, and that then put him on a path as to visiting his local mosque, where he met with Tablighi Jamaat, and it went from there. So I'm going to give you the cop-out answer and say, obviously, there's not one thing that puts him down the path, but I think the internet, the social dislocation, but also the dissemination of the ideology. I mean, this is the huge big difference to me from 10th September 2001 to modern day, is this stuff is just out there now. It's easy to get on the internet, it's easy to get on YouTube, you can find our Lackey lectures wherever you like, and the dissemination of the idea, I think, is probably one of the key things that has, for those that have converted and followed this path, that has been significant in their development.
And I would add too, again, having the foreign intelligence background, not confined to American converts or people who get their religion re-energized. Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the head of al-Qaeda in Iraq, troubled youth, juvenile delinquent, he got religion in school, or I'm sorry, he got religion in jail. And he came out of jail radicalized. And it was just an unhappy, rootless young man without a great deal of meaning in his life. And this is presented in front of them, and they hug it very closely.
Clearly, the topic of al-Qaeda and al-Qaeda-inspired offenses here in the States is, given the number of questions that we had remaining, and I'm sorry we couldn't get to you all, is a topic I think we might have to continue discussing going forward. I'd like to thank all of you for being here. I'd especially like to thank the Henry Jackson Society for choosing to partner with us to have this event. They are a nonpartisan UK-based think tank that looks at similar issues as CSIS, so I thank you for choosing CSIS as your venue. And of course, I'd like to thank both Robin and General Hayden for sharing their insights and for putting together such a great piece of work. So thank you.